the other Dalits were kind of distrustful of Sam Adams. And they say, well, Sam, we'll send troops, but only on one condition. The British have to fire first. If you fire first, we're not sending anybody to help you. So when Sam Adams left the First Continental Congress in 1774, there was one thing on his mind, James. How am I going to create this incident?
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, in a conversation that is coming to you on being recorded on April 15th, 2016, but we are going to release this on April 19th, 2016, which is, of course, a date that lives in infamy for a number of reasons throughout history, one in the not-so-distant past in Oklahoma City, but in the more distant past in April 19th, 1775, aka the date of the shot heard round the world, which every good American schoolboy and schoolgirl will no doubt know about, and they will have heard a certain version of the story of that shot and its significance in starting the Revolutionary War against the British. But maybe that story has some flaws, and maybe there are some points that we can make that will complicate and, well, change people's minds about what that story was and what it means. In order to do that, of course, we have a guest for you, and we are talking today to none other than James Perloff, who you will remember from several previous conversations on The Corbett Report. Just type James Perloff into the Corbett Report search bar, and you will find our previous conversations. And of course, I will direct you to jamesperloff.com, where you can find information about his works, his articles, and his books, including Truth is a Lonely Warrior, which, of course, we also had a previous conversation about. Let's bring him straight on. James Perloff, thank you for joining us today.
James, thank you for having me back on again.
All right, let's get into this conversation. And I think before we start the conversation, as I noted, there are a lot of people who already believe that they definitively know what took place on April 19th, 1775, because they have been taught it their entire lives. And a lot of people have their identity invested in the story of what happened to start the Revolutionary War, because it touches on a very, very important issue for American patriots. I'm sure there are some of them amongst the members of our audience. So, first of all, if we question April 19, 1775, does that mean that we are against the spirit of the Revolution and the Founding Fathers and liberty, and does this mean that we're ungodly communists?
It sure does. As a matter of fact, I've done just one show on this. So this is going to be a very, very unique program. This is going to be the first show that has actually debunked the Battle of Lexington as a false flag. And we're even going to debunk part of Paul Revere's ride. And the one show I allude to, the host of that show was afterwards called a communist. I was called something worse. The host of the radio station called me up 15 minutes after the show and said, some unkind things. He said, you know, attacking the Founding Fathers serves no useful purpose. But he only heard the very end of the show. And when I gave him the full context, he was much better with it. But another person who read my article, which tonight's broadcast is based on, Secrets Buried at Lexington Green, came up to me and said, so you're against the Bill of Rights, are you? Because, James, you know, there's this equation of Founding Fathers equals rights in the minds of Americans. And so they've become sort of untouchable. And what I want to point out is something that a lot of people don't know is that what we see in the Bill of Rights, Americans had that basically before the Revolutionary War. We were an ocean away from the British. There was no police state here. People said what was ever on their mind. They had freedom of speech. They could say King George stinks if they wanted, and nothing was going to happen, at least government-wise. I know Christians who have had tears in their eyes saying the Revolutionary War was fought so we could have the choice to go to what church we go to. But the truth is, we had all denominations in America at that time. We had Congregationalists and Presbyterians and Methodists and Anglicans and Baptists, and we had Quakers in Pennsylvania and Catholics down in Maryland. And King George III wasn't telling anybody what church to go to, so it wasn't about that. The right to bear arms, you know, this surprises people, but the Englishmen had their own Bill of Rights written in 1689, and that included the right to bear arms. Let me quote it, that the subjects which are Protestants, a little limited, right, may have arms for their defense suitable to their conditions and as allowed by law. And just to take one more example, the right to a trial by jury, that was embedded in our code of ethics. Now, it's true that the British disallowed that for violations of customs duties. But that's because they knew that if a jury of 12 Americans tried an American for violating British customs laws, they're going to find them innocent every time. They'll never make a dime off their customs regulations. So you had to go to an admiralty court like you go to a traffic court for breaking a traffic law. But if you committed a murder or other major offense, you got a jury trial. So these basic rights we see in the Bill of Rights, most of them, I'm not saying all of them, most of them were already there, and that's not what the revolution was really about. So we're not into attacking rights, but we do want to scrutinize the Battle of Lexington, and we don't want to hold the Founding Fathers as being above critical analysis.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, you do have an extensive article up on your site about this that, of course, we'll be linking to in the show notes, The Secrets Buried at Lexington Green, where you go through the information that we're going to be detailing here tonight. But let's start to bring everyone onto the same page. Again, I'm sure the American listeners will not need a lot of introduction to this, but Canadians like myself and others in the audience will not have learnt this as youngsters. So tell us the context of the Battle of Lexington. What was it about, and why is it important?
Here's exactly what happened. Year was 1775, and the British were occupying Boston. Now, why were they occupying it? It was because of the Boston Tea Party. The king and the parliament had demanded that Boston make good on the damaged goods, and under the control of Sam Adams, the political boss of Boston, the Bostonians refused to do that, so Parliament ordered the city of Boston closed, and that required a military occupation under General Thomas Gage. Now, in April of 75, General Gage received news that the colonists were storing a large amount of armaments out in the suburb of Concord. And I should remember something for our audience here, James, which is that by 1775, Boston had been divided into two camps. The loyalists in the suburbs and in New England were getting persecuted for their loyalty to the crown. So they're fleeing to Boston to get under the protection of the king's troops. At the same time, your most radical patriots were fleeing Boston to get away from the army, right? So you had two armed camps. You've got Boston loyalists. You've got the anti-King Georgers in the suburbs who are raising those famous Minuteman militias, right? And in April of 1775, General Gage assembled 700 foot soldiers at 9 p.m., the 18th, to march to Concord to gather up these armaments. This was simply a military maneuver. He wanted to neutralize these munitions because he was told they were going to be used against him by a colonial army. Now, this set in motion Paul Revere's famous ride. He rode out to Lexington to meet with Sam Adams and John Hancock, who were the leaders of the revolution here in Massachusetts. I'm from Massachusetts, I should mention. I grew up in Lexington, so this gives me a special interest in this battle. I walked home from high school every day right past the Battle Green in the Hancock Clark House, where Paul Revere met with Hancock and Adams, and past the Buckman Tavern where the militia met that morning. So this is an area that's close to my heart. In any event, at 5 o'clock in the morning, the British Army met with the Lexington militia. There were about 70 to 80 militia on Lexington to Green. And then the shot was fired that was heard around the world. And we're told this is very mysterious. Nobody knows who fired it. Was it the Americans? Was it the British? Nobody knows. But we do know that an exchange of musketry took place. And when all was said and done, there were 8 colonists dead and 9 wounded. And the British just suffered one minor wound, and that guy's wound was so minor, he kept marching. Then the British went out to Concord. They found there were fewer munitions than they expected. They destroyed what they could, and then there was a conflict at Concord Bridge with the local militia there. But at this point, militias from all over eastern Massachusetts were gathering. They'd been called by dispatch riders. And the British had a rough day for the rest of the day. Remember, they had no sleep the night before. Now they got to march back to Boston, and their ducks in a shooting gallery. They're being shot at from behind trees and walls and windows of houses, and they suffered 250 casualties. It was a rough day. But this is what set the Revolutionary War in America, which in turn created America. And we're going to present the idea today that this was actually a false flag.
All right, let's talk about the way that this battle was understood at the time. how it was propagated then, and how that changed over the years. When did the complicating aspects of this story start to emerge?
As I told you, I guess it was off air. I just got over a cold, so I'm going to be moistening my throat with some drinks here. I really need to rely on your audiovisual skills at this point, and so I'm counting on you to have some paintings of the Lexington battle up on the screen as I'm giving this narrative. And the first one we want to look at is from the fall of 1775. It's the engraving by Amos Doolittle. And if you look at this picture, you'll see that the British are firing, but no Americans are firing. They're dead, wounded, retreating, but they're not firing. They're not even loading. Then we go up to the lithograph produced by William Pendleton in 1830. And now we see that about half the colonists are shooting and half are retreating. Then we move up to the picture created by Hammett Billings in 1868. Now we see that most of the colonists are shooting and very few are retreating. Then we come to the Dawn of Liberty, a painting by Henry Sandham, 1886. And now we see that every colonist is standing his ground. They're shaking their fists. There's not one guy retreating. And you know what we've done, James, in truther terms? We've just boiled a frog. We've gone from 100% retreat to 100% defiance. And so the question is, why did these pictures change over the years? And by the way, I want to stress that I don't get the credit for discovering this. It was discovered by an historian named Harold Murdoch 100 years ago that these pictures had changed. Okay. Now, I don't want to tax your skills too much. We're not going to go through all the pictures again, but I need to go back to the first one of Doolittle, 1775. And this picture portrays the battle exactly as the provisional colonial government wanted it depicted to the rest of the colonies. And I have here a little printout as part of the Massachusetts Spy, which was the newspaper which was spread throughout the colonies and described the Battle of Lexington. And here's what it says. Americans, forever bear in mind the Battle of Lexington, where British troops, unmolested and unprovoked, wantonly, and in a most inhuman manner, fired upon and killed a number of our countrymen. It is noticed they fired upon our people as they were dispersing, agreeable to their command, and that we did not even return the fire. 8 of our men were killed, and 9 wounded. That part is accurate. The troops then laughed and damned the Yankees. All right, now, if you go to my website, I quote some depositions which were collected to prove what happened at Lexington. And some of these depositions were signed by Lexington militiamen. And the militiamen didn't deny firing, but you'll notice that in these depositions, and there's quite a few of them collectively, never once did anybody admit that a shot was fired by an American at Lexington, only the British. That's all that's on the record. Okay, so the question is, why did these pictures start to change? And the answer to that is that in 1824, America was getting ready to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the war. And the aging Marquis Lafayette, who had been one of Washington's generals, was visiting Concord, Massachusetts, and a politician there named Samuel Hoar was giving a speech. And he said, "Marquis, you are standing at the very spot where the first resistance was made to the British." Well, this caused outrage in my town of Lexington. The Lexingtonians demanded that the honor on the 50th anniversary of first resisting the British belong to them. And the Concordians said, "What are you guys talking about? There's nothing on the official record that says you guys discharged even one round that day." So what happened? The people of Lexington went around and they collected new depositions. These were from aged veterans and witnesses to the battle. And now they vigorously insisted, "We fired on the British on April the 19th, 1775. And this is the reason that the pictures began to change. And of course, the British had always said that the Americans fired in Lexington. And so today, James, with both the Americans and the British saying that, no one doubts that the first shots really were fired at Lexington. But if you don't mind, I want to take 2 minutes to go on to what I call a strange sidebar, which I noticed that there seems to be some kind of 50-year oath associated with the American Revolution. The first is with the Boston Tea Party. Now, you can look this up. Everybody who took part in the Boston Tea Party took an oath not to say anything about it for 50 years. That's a fact. And that's why no books by a participant were written until 1834, when you had George Hughes's book, Retrospect of the Boston Tea Party. So now you look at Lexington and you say it took 50 years for them to tell the truth about that. And there's one other I want to bring out. You may not be aware of this, James, but it has to do with the Declaration of Independence. Now, today we all assume that Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. But if you had asked that of someone around 1810, 1820, they'd say, we don't know. It actually was a state secret. And it wasn't until 45 years after the Declaration of Independence that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, who were the second and third president of the United States and had been on the drafting committee, began to drop some hints that it was Thomas Jefferson that wrote the Declaration. Actually, I'm going to contradict that. I'm going to say it was Thomas Paine. Pardon the cover on this book. It's published in 1947. It is Thomas Paine, author of the Declaration of Independence. And if you do, I'm glad to see you nodding your head. If anyone does a little online searching, they'll find many books and articles that prove both from the content and the style of the Declaration of Independence, it was Thomas Paine who wrote the Declaration.
And let me just throw in a link to an excellent Tragedy and Hope Peace Revolution podcast where they assembled a lot of the lectures and evidence and convinced me heartily that it was Thomas Paine.
Oh, terrific. We could actually do a show just on that. Not that we will. James, there were... I should mention that Thomas Paine was brought over here by Benjamin Franklin to write Common Sense, which was to incense the people to revolution. And then he wrote the Declaration. But there were actually three reasons why it could not be admitted that Thomas Paine wrote the Declaration. Number one, he was not an elected official. Number two, he was not an American. He was actually an Englishman. How do you like those apples? The Declaration of Independence was not even written by an American, okay? He was an Englishman for hire, basically sent here by Ben Franklin. And after the war, he returned to England and later he went to France and joined the French Revolution and even sat in their French assembly during the Reign of Terror. But the main reason I believe that Thomas Paine could not be admitted as the author of the Declaration of Independence was that he wrote a book in 1795 called The Age of Reason, which attacked Christianity. And it, since we had a large Christian population here in America, it could not be acknowledged that the Declaration was written by an enemy of Christianity, which he was very vividly in that book. And so they changed it to Thomas Jefferson. But in terms of 50-year oaths, here's something interesting. If there was a 50-year oath about who wrote the Declaration of Independence, it's kind of interesting that both Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, the second and third president, I'm reversing them there, third and second president of the United States, both died exactly on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. They both died on July the 4th, 1826. I always kind of romanticize that, and maybe we should just keep romanticizing it, but it does seem there is some sort of 50-year secrecy associated with the beginnings of America. And James, before I forget this, we can't go into this today, but I just want to let people know, although I'm focusing on Lexington and the false flag today, there is the lid is kind of coming off on America's beginnings, and there's a series of films I'll just mention by Chris Pinto, Hidden Faith of the Founding Fathers, and he's got a series called Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings. It talks about the occult architecture of Washington, D.C., the Freemasonry involved, which I'm about to get into with Lexington. And so there's a lot of the onions being peeled off the Founding Fathers, and I think it's time that this did come out. But let's get back to Lexington. And our next question should be, although I don't mean to direct the conversation too much here, but if the Americans admit now they fired at Lexington, our next question should be, who fired first?
Absolutely. And in fact, that was going to be my next question. So, okay. Who did fire first and how do we know?
The Americans fired first. And I'm saying this even though I've never been to Britain. I'm not pro-British, and I certainly don't, by the way, I'm not in favor of America returning to British rule or some ridiculous thing like that. Okay. There are three reasons I've been pointing out why the British reports are more likely reliable than the Americans. And the first is that the British admitted that they fired at the subsequent Battle of Concord first. At Concord Bridge, the Americans rushed down, confronted the British. The British sentries were nervous, and they opened fire, and the British admitted this. So why would they tell the truth about Concord and lie about Lexington? That's number one. Number two, some of the British in that army kept diaries, which were not intended for publication. In their personal diaries, they said the Americans fired first. So why would they lie to themselves? And here's something, James, maybe somebody in your audience knows this, but I have never seen a diary or a personal letter written by an American who witnessed the Battle of Lexington, not forced deposition for political motives, but just a personal diary that says the British fired first. But the third reason, perhaps the most important one, is that after 50 years, the Americans changed their story. In 1775, we didn't fire even in retaliation. 1825, yeah, we were giving it to the British that day. Now, if you're in court and you're a witness and you change your testimony, what does the judge do? He says, I don't think you're a very reliable witness. So I'm going to call it, the British are right, the Americans fired first on April the 19th, 1775.
All right. Well, that's, I mean, again, that is a huge thing because it really does set the context of the Revolutionary War and the story that Americans have told themselves for a long time. But as you alluded to earlier, there is a bigger story involving groups that most people don't know about that were operating in the area, including, of course, the Freemasons, who you alluded to being central in the foundation and formation of Washington, D.C., even in the architecture and layout of Washington, which, as you say, has been documented before. Let's talk about the role of the Freemasons in what happened at Lexington.
Yeah, and this is pretty good. You know, James, when you look back at history, almost wherever you see a revolution, you see the hand of Freemasonry. Certainly, the French Revolution, we know that hundreds of Freemasons sat in their assembly. We know that Benjamin Franklin was not only the Grand Master of Pennsylvania, but is the Grand Master of the Nine Sisters Lodge in Paris. It's hard to believe that the Freemason Marquis de Lafayette came over here. There's no Freemasonic connection. But if you look at the Mazzini revolutions, the Young Turk revolutions, the Portugal Revolution of 1910, even the Masons themselves have boasted of their role in these revolutions, and the American Revolution is no different. Now, of Washington's generals, we know that 33, at least 33, were Freemasons, including Washington himself. But here's something that I consider particularly significant to tonight's conversation. We all know about Paul Revere's ride. Paul Revere was sent on his ride by Dr. Joseph Warren in Boston, and Dr. Warren also sent a second rider as a backup, young William Dawes, and they rode out to Lexington to meet John Hancock at the Hancock-Clark House, which still stands today. But what your history books don't tell you is that Dr. Joseph Warren was Grand Master of St. Andrew's Lodge in Boston, and that Paul Revere, William Dawes, and John Hancock were all members of that lodge. So everybody on the circuit of Paul Revere's ride was a member of St. Andrew's Lodge, which happened to meet at the Green Dragon Tavern. And with what we know today, you know, that phrase just has a twinge more significance than it would have for a few years ago. Also, the Green Dragon Tavern is where the Sons of Liberty met that did the Boston Tea Party. And when you talk about St. Andrew's Lodge and the Sons of Liberty, you're pretty much they're not a complete overlap, but they're pretty much the same group. And I'm just mentioning one more thing about Freemasonry, James. In America today, Freemasonry is divided into the northern and southern jurisdiction. And where do you suppose the northern jurisdiction has its headquarters? Chicago? New York? No. The little town of Lexington, Massachusetts. And I don't think because it's the cradle of American liberty. I think it's because of the top Freemasonry. They know exactly what they did that morning.
Very interesting. So what was the real purpose of Revere's ride then?
Well, I believe that the real purpose was to set in motion the false flag, because the house where Hancock was staying with John Adams, his inseparable buddy, was only 1,000 feet behind Lexington Green where the battle took place the next morning. This was not a warning. This was to set up what happened the next day. But before we do that, James, I want to step back just one step further and talk about these men, Revere, Hancock, and Adams, and a little bit about the revolution and the alleged motives for it. And this is going to come as kind of a shock to some of your listeners. especially those who are more patriotic. And by the way, I'm patriotic, nothing against patriotism. But by 1773, you know, we're always told that the main reason for the revolution was this onerous British taxation policy, right? And when I grew up, that's what we were told, that, you know, that we would become the tax slaves of Britain and we just couldn't take it any longer. And we just had to go to war with this. But the truth is that by 1773, Britain was laying no taxes on America whatsoever, with the sole exception of a customs duty on tea of 3 pennies per pound, which was nominal. And that's it. And I'm not joking. And if anybody wants to challenge that, they're welcome. Now, I know that there were some taxes before that, but I want to just relate this to modern times, James. You know how good guys turn into bad guys overnight? One day ISIS is good guys, now they're the bad guys. The Taliban, right. Saddam Hussein's a good guy, now he's a bad guy. World War II, the Russians are the good guys, and overnight they're the bad guys, right? Okay. Same thing if you check out the British. They're the good guys during the French and Indian War, right? They're helping us fight the French. They're the good guys. It's save us from the French, right? Okay. All right. Now, 1763, suddenly it flips. Suddenly the British are the bad guys and the French save us from the British. If you don't think something's wrong with this, this is a continuum of history, James. But to look at it, why did the British tax us in the first place? It's because the French and Indian War had doubled their national debt. And the British taxpayers felt, you know, we shouldn't pay off this debt alone. The Americans are the chief beneficiary, so they should pay something. So in 1764, Parliament passed the Tea Act, which put a tax of 3 pennies on a gallon of molasses. That was it, okay? That cost Sam Adams, Sons of Liberty, to hold violent protests across the nation. And so the British repealed it, and they enacted the Stamp Act, which would have put a tax on things like contracts and diplomas, which already worked in England with no problem. But that was violently protested, and so the British repealed that as well. And at this point, they said, okay, we've had enough. And they called Benjamin Franklin before Parliament in 1766. And I want to read this because I think it's significant. This is the actual exchange between Benjamin Franklin and the Parliament. Parliament, did you ever hear the authority of Parliament to make laws for America question till lately? Franklin's answer. The authority of Parliament was allowed to be valid in all laws except such as should lay internal taxes. It was never disputed in laying duties to regulate commerce. Parliament. Was it an opinion in America before 1763 that the Parliament had no right to lay taxes and duties there? Franklin. I never heard an objection to the right of laying duties to regulate commerce, but a right to lay internal taxes was never supposed to be in Parliament, as we're not represented there. Parliament. On what do you found your opinion that the people in America make any such distinction? Franklin. I know that whenever the subject has occurred in conversation where I have been present, it has been the opinion of everyone that we cannot be taxed by Parliament where we're not represented. But the payment of duties laid by an act of Parliament as a regulation of commerce was never disputed, unquote, Benjamin Franklin. So Parliament said, okay, you Americans are okay with us regulating our own commerce. That's where your tea tax comes from. That's what they called the Townshend Acts of 1767 came from. But these were, again, violently protested by the colonies. These were customs duties. And so finally they give up and they repeal that, and with everything, with the sole exception of the tea tax. Now, I realize that the strongest American patriots who think that being too soft on the British will say, but they didn't have representation. That was the big deal. That was a big deal, even though these taxes were pretty small. And by the way, James, American taxpayers today, they pay income on their wages, state income tax, real estate tax, excise tax, sales tax, Medicare tax, Social Security tax. King George III was taxing none of that. Very, very mild by comparison. But I recently saw a meme that cracked me up, and it's this one here. As it turns out, taxation with representation also sucks. And I just want to point out why the representation issue was not a big deal. Number one, We had a much smaller population, so we would have been outvoted on tax issues anyway by Britain if we did, were represented. Number two, serving in Parliament was not paid. I don't know you're going to find anybody who wants to live in England unpaid to do this. Number three, perhaps the most important thing, James, it's a two-month ocean voyage. No steamers back then, no cell phones, no emails. So if Parliament has a tax bill and you want to sound out your constituency, if you're a representative in Parliament, you've got to take a two-month sea voyage or send a letter that requires a two-month voyage, regather your constituents, get their opinion, and another two-month voyage back to England. That is not practical. As far as I'm concerned, the representation issue is not a substantial one. It's certainly not enough of an issue to make blood run in the street and have tens of thousands of people dying. It's an excuse for a war, not a cause for one.
Well, you lay that out very well, but then the question is, well, surely, I mean, we know demonstrably that a lot of colonists were upset. They did start the war. They did engage the British. Why? Why were they so insensible? How did that happen?
I think, James, for the same reason that we have wars now, against places like Iraq and Libya and Syria, because a lot of people just listen to what they're told by their leaders instead of thinking it through and looking at what the actual logical consequences of the war are, or whether or not the justification like weapons of mass destruction really exist. I don't think there was justification for the war myself. I know I'm ticking off a lot of American patriots. Again, I'm not attacking patriotism, but I do think that if you start to examine the history of America, you'll find that it actually is part of the apparatus of the New World Order, and they had to have an excuse to get that war going.
Interesting. Well, let's start attacking that question of what role does America play in the New World Order? Why did they do this? And perhaps we can do that most effectively by looking at those central characters of this story that you were talking about, for example, Sam Adams and John Hancock and Paul Revere.
Okay, yeah, let me talk about these guys. And because I don't want to sound like it's just me talking, I want to quote an American historian who will back me, just to get a little backup here, okay? Thomas Hallahan, a relatively recent book, The Day the American Revolution Began.
William Hallahan?
William H. Hallahan. Perhaps I said his name wrong. He said this of Sam Adams. By the way, have you noticed that some people who were in the revolution have been forgotten about? We remember Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, the second president, and we remember George Washington, but we've forgotten about Sam Adams. But Sam Adams was actually called the father of the American Revolution. He's the one who started the Sons of Liberty. And Thomas Jefferson said he was more responsible for the war than anybody else. So he was a pretty significant figure. But here's what Hallahan says about him, quote, Samuel Adams was gathering and organizing a collection of waterfront mobs who were controlled by his lieutenant, Will Molyneux, and on occasion by Paul Revere. Henceforth, Boston was controlled by a trained mob glorified by its title, the Sons of Liberty. Sam Adams was its keeper. Adams fashioned another powerful revolutionary tool when he helped spread Sons of Liberty organizations elsewhere in the colonies, where they could be orchestrated into mobs for demonstrations, intimidation, and street violence coordinated with events in Boston, unquote. Now, James, just as an example, you know, most people today just know that Sam Adams is on beer bottles, and I think that's appropriate because he used to get his mobs liquored up, and then he would designate someone for them to attack, and a famous example is the Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson. He lied to the mob. He told them that Thomas Hutchinson thought up the Stamp Act. That was completely false. Thomas Hutchinson was not in Parliament. He was a Massachusetts-born citizen, but Adams hated him. So 500 people, dead drunk, could hardly see in front of themselves, marched in his home. The Hutchinson family got wind of it and escaped with their lives, but the house was attacked all night with axes. All their belongings were stolen, and precious papers on Massachusetts history were destroyed. That was a rather typical act by Sam Adams, who then blamed it on passing vagabond strangers. And he ruled by violence. There was, for example, a woman in Barnstable, Mass. Named Abigail Freeman. And she was loyal to King George III, and she said so vocally. So her home was broken into by young thugs who stripped her naked, this elderly widow, and tarred her and feathered her. and made her write a poll until she renounced King George III. Now, I know that Sam Adams has lots of great quotes on Wikipedia about freedom and our sacred rights, but rights don't mean much if they don't apply to people that disagree with you. We also had a newspaper in Boston called the Boston Chronicle. It was founded by John Mine, who founded the first circulating library in Boston, and it criticized Sam Adams, especially his associate John Hancock, for trading with the British when all the other merchants in Boston who were not friendly with Adams were required to not trade with the British at great loss to themselves. So he was attacked on the street by 20 thugs with clubs, and his office was ransacked, and he was forced to flee Boston, and there went freedom of speech. There was no justice. So he ran it basically as through mob violence, which is not the way freedom works. And if you want to know how Hancock and Revere related to him, John Hancock was the money man. Sam Adams came from a wealthy family, but he ran his father's malt factory and other businesses into the ground. He was in great debt. And John Hancock was the wealthiest man in Massachusetts, perhaps in all the colonies. And he became the financier of the revolution. And if you'll notice, Sam Adams always gave John Hancock the most important positions. He would get to run the colonial government in Massachusetts, and Adams would be the number two man. And after the war, when Massachusetts became a state, the governor was John Hancock. The lieutenant governor was Sam Adams. But it's always Sam who's really calling the shots. If you want a modern comparison, Sam Adams is Dick Cheney, and John Hancock is George Bush. John Hancock, I should mention, a very vain man. He rode around in a gilded carriage he had built for him in England. He thought he was going to be appointed the commander of the colonial army when the revolution broke out. So he had tailors make up special ornate uniforms to be commander-in-chief. And when he found out that George Washington was going to command the army and not him, he had a grudge against Washington that festered for years. But he was the number two man in all of this. And Paul Revere was Sam Adams' top lieutenant. I want to give you a quote that's going to shock some people. Because Boston was being run by mob violence, not by a true democratic process, in 1768, British troops came and occupied the city temporarily. I'm going to read you a quote from Captain Granville Evelyn of the British Army, written to his clergyman father back in the UK. He said, quote, "Our arrival has in great degree restored that liberty that they have so long been deprived of, even liberty of speech and security to their persons and property, for which years past has been at the mercy of a most villainous mob," unquote, Captain Evelyn of the British Army. That's a quote you never saw in your American history books.
You certainly didn't. How does Revere relate to this pair?
Well, he helps run the mobs, and he's an excellent horseman, and he carries the messages for them. But he is one of their top lieutenants carrying out instructions. He was the best horseman around, and I can tell you that on the night of April the 19th, 1775, James, he would have won the Kentucky Derby. The British horsemen had to give up. They tried to chase him out of Boston that night, and the horse Brown Bess died from that ride. So he was an excellent horseman. He was a dispatcher, and he carried out, and we're going to talk about some of Paul Revere's ride. It's going to get pretty interesting for us. And before we talk about the Battle of Lexington, James, I know this is a long interview, but we're talking about something that most people have never heard before. It's pretty unique. I want to talk briefly about the Boston Massacre, which I know most of your American listeners have heard of, because it was the prototype that generated what was intended to be called the Lexington Massacre. So if you go on Wikipedia or other sources, you'll find one of the trademark quotes of Sam Adams was, quote, "Put your enemy in the wrong and keep him so is a wise maxim in politics as well as in war," unquote. So these British troops that came to occupy Boston in 1768, as you can imagine, what Sam Adams wanted to do was to get rid of them, and he had to have a pretext. So on the night of March the 5th, 1770, the mobs came out of the taverns, summoned by the bell, as usual, and they were gathered together and on King Street. They surrounded the lone British sentry guarding the customs house. that sentry called for help, and the nearby barracks held some troops. Captain Thomas Preston and seven soldiers came to his rescue. And at this point, it's late at night, but you have nine British soldiers who are surrounded by a mob of 300 to 400. They close in on the soldiers. They're pelting them with rocks and concrete and or pavement, I should say, snowballs and ice balls, and they're hitting them with clubs at the point of crisis. And they're also yelling fire, fire at the soldiers because they know they're under orders not to fire at civilians. Finally, one of the soldiers who's knocked down by a club got up, shot his assailant, and others did so. Three were killed, three in the mob were killed, two were mortally wounded. And this became known as the Boston Massacre, which I think is something of a hyperbole for three dead and two mortally wounded. But in any event, the very next day, Sam Adams and John Hancock formed a commission demanding that all British troops be removed from Boston. And they collected depositions, just as they did after the Boston incident, to prove what happened. Well, Sam Adams envisioned that the British troops would be hung from the gallows for murder. But fortunately, his second cousin, John Adams, who became our second president, ran the defense for the British. And he got the jurors from outside Boston, which is a very wise move. And he got testimony from 35 people that there had been a plan in advance to attack the British that night. And the real blow for Sam Adams came when one of the mortally wounded men, Patrick Carr, confessed on his deathbed, made a deathbed confession. He forgave the British soldier who shot him, saying he'd done so in self-defense. And he said that in his native Ireland, he'd never seen British soldiers show such self-restraint as they had that night. That killed the case. Nobody's hung from the gallows. But Sam Adams learned a lesson, which is don't let these cases go to trial. The next time this happened, there ain't going to be no trial. There's just going to be our depositions, and that's what happened. But James, just to reinforce the role of Revere and Hancock in all of this, because this is a very important trio, I want you to have on your screen at this point Paul Revere's very famous print of the Boston Massacre. And what I want people to know about this print is if you look it up online, you'll find that this print has about 12 falsehoods in it, inaccuracies, misrepresentations, whatever you'll call them. It shows the British troops firing on the command of an officer, which they did not. The officer, Thomas Preston, was trying to restrain them. It shows an orderly volley, which it was not. It shows the British are smiling and enjoying killing the Americans, which they were not. It greatly decreases the size of the crowd. It shows it happening in broad daylight when it was late at night, and so on and so forth. And actually, there was an artist named Henry Pelham who claimed that Paul Revere stole that picture from him anyway. So Paul Revere does not get high marks for honesty on that picture. But I'm also going to read to you the, an excerpt from a speech given by John Hancock on the third anniversary of the British incident, the Boston Massacre. And James, I want you to decide if this sounds like propaganda or truth to you. The words of John Hancock, which many historians believe were written for him by Sam Adams. Quote, "I forbear and come reluctantly to the transaction of that dismal night when Satan, with his chosen band, opened the sluices of New England's blood and sacrilegiously polluted our land with the dead bodies of her guiltless sons. Let this sad tale of death never be told without a tear. Let every parent tell the shameful story to his listening children until tears of pity glisten in their eyes and boiling passions shake their tender frames. Let all America join in one common prayer to heaven that the inhuman, unprovoked murders of the 5th of March, 1770, executed by the cruel hand of Preston and his sanguinary coadjutors, may ever stand in history without a parallel." And it goes on for another hour, but I'm not going to...
I'll give him an A- for his rhetoric. I would give him a full A, but it was a bit hyperbolic. Just a tad.
So that is the story of the Boston Massacre and the roles that they played in it. And now, James, I want to move ahead to the main feature of our story tonight, which is the Lexington incident which inaugurated the Revolutionary War. And James, in 1774, the first Continental Congress was held, and Sam Adams went to it, of course. He was one of the people who provoked it. And at that Congress, Sam Adams asked the other delegates from other colonies, who, some of whom were moderate and some of whom were extremist, if war breaks out between British troops and the colonials in Massachusetts, will you other colonies send troops to help us? And the other delegates were kind of distrustful of Sam Adams. And they say, well, Sam, we'll send troops, but only on one condition. The British have to fire first. If you fire first, we're not sending anybody to help you. So when Sam Adams left this, the First Continental Congress in 1774, there was one thing on his mind, James. How am I going to create this incident? Now, in 1775, the Second Continental Congress was going to be held. Sam Adams was going to be going. It was scheduled for May. And John Hancock was going to be the president of the nation's Second Continental Congress. But General Gage had not ventured his troops outside of Boston. There was no British-fired incident had taken place. And if it didn't happen, then when Sam Adams went empty-handed to the Second Continental Congress, they were going to say, what's the big deal? Why do we need a war? So let's talk about Paul Revere's ride. General Gage had received exaggerated reports of the amount of munitions being held in Concord. Some of them came from a controversial agent named Dr. Benjamin Church, who people's true loyalties debate to this very day. Revere rides out, and what we've been told is, famously, as he said, the redcoats are coming, the regulars are out, alarming the countryside, and that he went to Lexington to meet Sam Adams and John Hancock to warn them that the British were coming to arrest them and they'd best make off. And I'm going to dispute that, James, for several reasons. Number one, if you're going to arrest a couple of men, 700 foot soldiers seems like a very inefficient way to do that. If I was General Gage and I wanted to arrest them, I'd send out a secret group of cavalrymen, a small group, and do it in secret. I wouldn't send 700 marching troops to do that. Number two, we have a copy of General Gage's orders to Lieutenant Colonel Smith, who commanded the expedition. It makes no mention of arresting Adams and Hancock, although I should mention that he had been authorized by Parliament to arrest revolutionary leaders, though he never did so. He knew it'd agitate the American public. Thirdly, when the British arrived in Lexington, they never made any movement in the direction of the Hancock-Clark House. They weren't the least bit interested in it. And also, I should mention that Hancock and Clark actually had known, even before Revere arrived, they'd known since 9 o'clock the previous evening that the British were coming, and they were in no hurry to get out of there. They didn't leave until a couple of hours before. So there's no special alarm on their part that they're about to be arrested. James, they're in a house 1,000 feet behind Lexington Green. I used to take that walk every day when I left high school. It takes about 4 minutes. They had plenty of time to scope out this false flag. And remember, Sam Adams is obsessed with his goal of creating a British fired first incident. I believe Paul Revere did not go out to warn them. I believe he went out to orchestrate a false flag, which you, I know, on your show have discussed many false flags with many people in the alternative media movement.
All right. I suppose we should talk about what actually happened on that day and Revere's movements and his arrival at Lexington Green. Let's talk about the context of the battle itself.
Yes. Something happened which was quite interesting. Paul Revere and John Adams and Sam Adams and John Hancock all left the Hancock house about 2 hours before the British arrived in Hancock's gilded carriage. But 30 minutes before the British arrived, the British arrived at 5 a.m. At 30 minutes before that, at 4:30 a.m., Paul Revere mysteriously returns and he arrives at Buckman's Tavern where the Lexington militia have been summoned. And the official reason he gave, and this is what your history books will tell you, is that John Hancock had forgotten a very important trunk that he had stored at Buckman's Tavern, and Paul Revere had come to fetch it because he was so afraid that the trunk would fall into British hands. Now, I'm going to give you 5 reasons why Paul Revere's story is bogus. Number one, John Hancock had already been to Buckman's Tavern that morning. We know that from the letters of his fiancée, Dorothy Quincy. He'd already been there. If the trunk was so all important, why didn't you just grab it then and leave? Number two, The British were not searching houses on the way to Concord. I should mention, if I didn't already, this is important for our context, Lexington is on the way to Concord. It's the town that precedes Concord. But the British were not searching houses and taverns on the way over. So the idea that they were going to search Buckman's tavern for a trunk belonging to him was zero concern. Number three, okay, Paul Revere arrives at 4:30. Why not grab the trunk and go if it's so important? Why does he wait until the British arrive? Number four, after the British arrive and are on the scene at Lexington Green, now Paul Revere and a fellow Freemason who he's brought with him from St. Andrew's Lodge, Thomas Lowell, according to the official story, now haul this hefty trunk out. Now, James, to do this in the view of the British is to call attention to the trunk. If you want to spare this trunk from British capture, the best thing is to leave it in Buckman's Tavern under a blanket. They're never going to find it. They're not looking for it. And his story makes no sense. I believe he's there to orchestrate this false flag. And reason number five, if Hancock wanted that trunk so badly, why doesn't he send his carriage for it? All that Revere would have to do, throw the trunk on the carriage, off they go, merrily on their way. Why haul this big trunk on foot? It doesn't make any sense. But James, here's something that's really, really weird. And if people Google this, Google John Hancock and Salmon Fish. If you go to the Hancock Clark House, they love to tell the story. According to the official story, John Hancock got hungry that morning, the day the American Revolution began, and he sent his trunk back to the Hancock Clark House to get a salmon fish for his breakfast. Now, why would you send a complete trunk to carry a little salmon fish, but you don't send it to get this big, heavy trunk? It really makes no sense at all. I have a theory on what was really being carried by that trunk, but I can't prove it. But in any event, I do not believe Paul Revere's official story. James, let's move on to the shot heard around the world. I believe there were actually about 10 shots fired. They were heard around the world, as the saying goes. All of them, it seems, missed, because as we mentioned at the outset, there was not a single British death in Lexington. And I'm going to make the case now that these shots were not fired by the Lexington militia, nor were they fired, of course, by the British, but they were fired by hidden gunmen in concealed locations in the darkness of 5 o'clock in the morning. Now, James, if it's possible, I'd appreciate it if you can get a map up that I've sent you. It's the best map I have ever seen. I wish I gave credit for it. It's a superb map of what unfolded on the morning of April the 19th, 1775 at Lexington Green. And it shows the British confronting the American militia. And I want to point out something really, really weird about Lexington Green, James. The American militia, as you know, were famous for firing behind trees and walls. They never fought in open formation. But on the morning of April the 19th, this time and this time only, they stand in parade formation with their guns at the breasts. Now, why did they do that? They had been ordered to do it by Hancock and Adams before those two took off. But why? Well, the British are being given no choice. They've got 70 armed militia on the green in front of them. They can't continue to conquer and leave these guys on their flank. So they move left and right to flank them. And Major John Pitcairn, who's commanding the lead part of the expedition, moves forward. And everybody on both sides agrees. He says this. He said, "Ye villains, ye curs, throw down your villains and disperse." And the men began to disperse. They've been told on both sides, British and Americans told, don't start any incidents. We don't want any shooting incidents taking place. But all of a sudden, some shots ring out. And I'm going to quote some eyewitnesses on this. I can't quote them all, but you go to my website, the article, The Secrets Buried at Lexington Green. This is from an American named George Leonard. It's from General Gage's collection, because General Gage was trying to find out what happened. Quote, "George Leonard of Boston deposes that he went from Boston on the 19th of April with a brigade commanded by Lord Percy." This is the backup relief brigade. "Upon their march to Lexington, the being on horseback and having no connection with the army, he met several times ahead of the brigade, on which excursion he met with a countryman," meaning a fellow American, "who was wounded, supported by two others who were armed. This was about a mile this side of Lexington Meeting House. The deponent asked the wounded person what was the matter with him. He answered that the regulars had shot him. The deponent then asked what provoked them, the regulars, to do it. He said that some of our people fired upon the regulars, and they fell on us like bulldogs and killed eight. He further said it was not the company he belonged to that fired, meaning the Lexington militia, but some of our country people that were on the other side of the road. The deponent inquired of the other men if they were present. They answered yes and related the affair much as the wounded men had done. All three blamed the rashness of their own people for firing first. May the 4th, 1775, Boston, George Leonard. Now, backing this up, James, are the British accounts. Now, we recall earlier we went over the fact that there's a lot of evidence that shows that the British accounts are more accurate than the American accounts. Quoting Lieutenant Sutherland, quote, "We went further when three shots were fired at us, which we did not return. And this is sacred truth, as I hope for mercy. These three shots were fired from the corner of a large house to the right of the church." That is Buckman's Tavern, across the street, exactly as George Leonard had said. Now, James, if we read the rest of the testimonies from Major Pitcairn and the rest, we find that four or five more men fired from a wall behind a wall, and others fired from concealed locations to the left. All told, I'm going to guess something in the neighborhood of 10 shots were fired. Now, the amazing thing is that the Minutemen were famed for their marksmanship, yet not one British dead at Lexington. They were either firing without bullets in their guns, or they were firing on missing on purpose, but they kept firing, very similar to the Lexington Massacre, provoking the British to the point that they fired back. And the reason you have all these dead and wounded Americans at Lexington Green and no British dead, Sam Adams, he didn't want any British dead. He wanted another massacre that he could report to the entire country. He wanted a British fired first incident, just as he'd gotten the promise of he would get troops from other colonies to join the Massachusetts cause. James, these shots could not have been fired by the Lexington militia for a number of reasons. The Lexington militia, they were a tight-knit group. They were members of the same families, brothers and cousins and uncles and fathers and nephews, and they're not going to set up their own friends and neighbors and kinsmen to be shot. These are outsiders who have come in, and I have to say that I believe that it's Paul Revere and his friend Thomas Lowell and the rest of the Sons of Liberty who probably came in on that carriage that allegedly came for the salmon fish that were brought in to fire these shots. And adding interest to this, James, in examining the the official depositions, I found something very interesting. The depositions of the Lexington militiamen, which were collected, 34 deponents signed a statement that said, quote, "Not a gun was fired by any person in our company on the regulars before they fired on us. In our company." Okay, another 14 signed a statement, quote, "The regulars fired on the company before a gun was fired by any of our company on them." They're not denying Americans fired first. They're denying it was our company, because I think these American militiamen who survived were too honest to say that no American shots were fired. So they were persuaded to sign a statement saying that nobody in our company fired first. And that's how Hancock and Adams got away with it.
It makes sense, but to play devil's advocate, how else would that have been phrased? How would they have framed that? That no American fired first? Would they have said that? I think they would have used the word company in that statement.
I think that they would have said countrymen, as George Leonard did. They said our countrymen rashly fired from the other side of the street. I think these depositions were carefully guided. In fact, I want to read, this is something I find really interesting. It's amazing what you can find out when you're starting to look online. I found this deposition about the Boston Massacre of 1770, written by a deponent named John Wilson. Quote, "Some small boys coming up made a noise to the soldiers, on which the officer said to them, 'Why don't you fire? Damn you, fire!' They thereupon fired." Now here's a deposition from the Battle of Lexington, 5 years later, 1775, from William Draper, who wasn't even a resident of Lexington. For some reason, he happened to be in town that day. Quote, "The commanding officer of the troops gave the command to the troops, 'Fire, damn you, fire!' And immediately they fired." He's using the exact same words, even though we're talking about two separate incidents, 5 years apart, two different officers. James, to my knowledge, it was not the habit of the British officers to curse their men to get them to shoot. In fact, we know that in both these incidents, the firing was spontaneous. But if you take a look, if I can ask you to use your audiovisual skills one more time and place Paul Revere's print of the Boston Massacre next to Doolittle's 1775 print of the Lexington Massacre, note the similarities. You have a British officer with his sword in the air giving the command. A orderly volley is given, and the Americans are, without any provocation being given by them, are being slaughtered by the British. It's the same M.O., Boston Massacre, Lexington Massacre. And I want to, before I close off, James, I want to give you one more thing. I started out by reading this thing from the Massachusetts Spy, the official organ that gave people in the rest of the colonies what had supposedly happened in Lexington. And you know all about baby incubators, right? Okay. Let me read from this again. Americans, forever bear in mind the Battle of Lexington, where British troops, unmolested and unprovoked, wantonly, in a most inhuman manner, fired upon and killed a number of our countrymen, then robbed them of their provisions, ransacked, plundered, and burnt their houses. Nor could the tears of defenseless women, some of whom were in the pains of childbirth, the cries of helpless babes, nor the prayers of old age, confined to beds of sickness, appease their thirst for blood. Well, unquote. Just to look at this historically, as far as elderly in beds of sickness goes, there was only one elderly man killed by the British that day. He wasn't killed, actually. It's Samuel Whittemore, 79 years old, did fire on the British. He killed two of them, wounded another mortally. The British didn't know how old he was. They went up and they bayoneted him, but he didn't die from his wounds. He lived another 18 years, and he died at the age of 97. There's your elderly. And as far as the defenseless women, the pains of childbirth, and the cries of helpless babes, well, the only case we know of, the British did burn some houses that they were fired on. If you fired at the British from a house, they would go up and often and burn that house. There was a woman named Hannah Adams who had an 18-day-old child, and the British said, "We're burning this house, lady, you better get out." But that's it. But across the country, Americans were told that there were countless cases of the elderly in their sick beds and the defenseless women and helpless babes being butchered by the British.
As it ever was. I mean, war propaganda is war propaganda, and it always looks and sounds and smells the same.
Doesn't it?
Yes.
But, you know, I think for a lot of Americans, including me at one point, I think this came as kind of a shock because I had grown up with this very view of the Founding Fathers as these sort of infallible heroes of truth. And by the way, I'm not taking a rap here at George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or others. I'm basically concentrating on my state of Massachusetts, which, by the way, Parliament said was more trouble than all the other colonies put together. And I think that probably is true. We had the Boston Massacre, we had the Boston Tea Party, and we had the shots that began the whole darn thing. So this was pretty much a Massachusetts event. And James, I do want to give an acknowledgement, which is very much due here. I want to acknowledge an Englishman named Paul Noble, who helped me when I was researching this article. I wanted to get information about the British perspective on the Revolutionary War, which I found was missing. Paul Noble is a very distinguished Briton. And he helps the UKIP. He's a British nationalist. He's very much anti-EU. He's our kind of guy. He's a great guy. And we must have exchanged about 60 emails about this. You know what happened? He was on a flight home from Singapore, and he was forced to watch the movie The Patriot made by Mel Gibson. I should mention that I was told by the tour guide at Buckman Tavern that originally Mel Gibson was going to make the movie The Patriot about Paul Revere, but when he found that Paul Revere basically vanished after his famous ride and there was no sign that he was out shouldering a musket with the rest of the troops, he decided that maybe he'd look elsewhere for a hero to make into a Revolutionary War movie. But Paul Noble, I want to thank you for the great assistance you provided me in helping to decipher the events of April the 19th, 1775, which, of course, open to challenge anybody who wishes to, but the more I study history, James, the more I find that it does follow a definite pattern.
All right. Well, you lay out a very detailed and interesting case, and people, again, can look for more of those details and the links and the things that you cite in your article on the secrets buried at Lexington Green, again, linked in the show notes. But I guess we should put all of this into perspective for people. At the end of the day, why should people care at this point who fired the shots that hurt around the world? And what does this tell us about what the real beginnings of the American project enterprise really were about?
Well, I hope that it might inspire people to start to look beyond some of the mythology we grew up in our mainstream history textbooks, much of which has been used to drive us to the current patriotic fervor that still takes place in driving us into wars that we find are so often unjustified in the Middle East for an ultimate goal of a new world order. I think that America was very much part of the inception. America was very much a part of this new world order, and I hope that we might motivate people to look in that direction. And I hope this might also serve as further affirmation that war is a dreadful thing, and that the reasons for war often turn out to be unjustified.
All right, well said. I just have two short closing questions. One, given that it wasn't likely salmon that Sam Adams sent his carriage back for, what do you think he was sending it for?
Pure speculation. I believe he sent them back to collect the gunmen.
Makes sense. Question number two. Where can people direct their hate mail and or fan mail?
to www.jamesperloff.com. My last name is spelled P as in Peter, E-R-L-O-F-F. It's jamesperloff.com. And if you go on the welcome page and you will find the article, The Secrets Buried at Lexington Green, the dead are buried there, but I believe there's secrets buried there too. That secret began to come out, as we've reviewed, 50 years after the fact.
Interesting. But, 50 years.
The Corbett Report now has brought out more of the secrets of Lexington.
Well, thanks to you for the research and to Paul Noble for helping you out with that research. Again, a lot of interesting little facts in here that a lot of people won't have heard before. So I hope, again, at the very least, they'll go and review the evidence for themselves. Again, jamesperloff.com. James Perloff, thank you again for another very interesting conversation.
Thank you, Corbett. It's always interesting with you.
The Corbett Report is brought to you by The Corbett Report Subscriber, a weekly newsletter featuring James Corbett's International Forecaster editorial, recommended reading and viewing, discounts on Corbett Report DVDs, and once a month, a subscriber-only video. Sign up today to start receiving your copy at corbettreport.com/support.